evening, everybody. I have the pleasure to introduce you our guest from Russia, Mikhail Maslovsky. We have a similar name, but it's just an accident. It is not planned. From Nizhny Novgorod State University. Maybe I will ask you to introduce yourself.
Yes.
And thank you again for visiting us.
Thank you. So my name is Mikhail Maslovsky, and I am a professor of Department of Sociology and Social Work of Nizhny Novgorod State University. I would like also to thank Dr. Irzhi Schubert, who is not here today, for inviting me to Prague. And Dr. Schubert acts as a kind of a link between historical sociologists in the Czech Republic and in Russia. So I would like to present a paper which is titled The Soviet Model of Modernity and the Political Transformations in Post-Communist Russia. Analysis of the Soviet version of modernity did not occupy the central place in a new wave of historical sociology that began in the 1960s. Although some aspects of the rise of the Soviet system were discussed from the sociological perspectives. Thus, one of the founders of contemporary historical sociology, Barrington Moore, analyzed the Soviet political regime in his early works. But in his masterpiece, Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy, he turned to China as an example of the third route to the modern world. The Soviet regime was considered by such representatives of new historical sociology as Teda Skocpol and Michael Mann, but the character of the Soviet system as a specific version of modernity was not fully acknowledged in their works. The rise of the modern state was one of the central issues in historical sociology. An influential approach to this problem was offered by Anthony Giddens, and particularly in his work, The Nation, State, and Violence. In that work, Giddens also referred to the example of the Soviet state, including the Stalinist dictatorship. This part of Giddens' analysis of the modern state was not widely discussed in historical sociology. Giddens considers the Soviet system from the viewpoint of his theory of the four institutional dimensions of modernity. They include industrial production, capitalist market economy, the system of surveillance, and the state's monopoly of the means of violence. Obviously, only three of these could be found in Soviet-type societies. Since Giddens regards capitalism as an essential component of modernity, from the viewpoint of his theory, the non-capitalist developmental path, which was followed by the Soviet Union, must be considered as non-modern. But Giddens himself does not see any contradictions in his approach. Giddens analyzes the Stalinist dictatorship on the basis of the totalitarian model. It is noteworthy that he chose that theoretical source in the middle of the 1980s, when the totalitarian paradigm was criticized by some revisionist historians. At the same time, Giddens complements the totalitarian model with his own analysis of the modern state, employing Michel Foucault's theory of disciplinary power. For Giddens, totalitarianism could only emerge in the conditions of the modern nation-state. As he writes, the possibilities of totalitarian rule depend upon the existence of societies in which the state can successfully penetrate the day-to-day activities of most of its subject population. This presumes a high level of surveillance. Another component of totalitarian rule is the ability of police or paramilitary forces to deploy the technology of industrialized war against an unarmed or poorly armed population. As Giddens writes, the threat of use of modern weapons allows a much higher degree of control over the population, than it was possible in traditional states. Giddens also considers the Soviet example when he analyzes the military aspect of the modern state. Thus, he discusses militarization of Soviet economy since the 1930s. According to Giddens, the model of a war economy and building up military strength were essential components of the totalitarian regime. Finally, Giddens considers the place which was occupied by the USSR within the global system of nation-states. Apparently, Giddens believes that the USSR represented a specific example of the modern nation-state. But it should be noted that this approach ignores the imperial character of the Soviet system, which became conspicuous under Stalin's rule. Another well-known representative of historical sociology, Michael Mann, discusses the example of the Soviet system in his article The Contradictions of Continuous Revolution, which is devoted to a comparative analysis of the Nazi dictatorship in Germany and the Stalinist regime in the USSR. According to Mann, there were important differences between these regimes. As he notes, the Bolsheviks abolished capitalism, the Soviet Union was bigger, less industrialized and modern, more secular and ethnically diverse, and women were more equal. Their prior histories and seizures of power also differed. But in Mann's opinion, despite the differences between them, these two regimes belong together. What made both dictatorships historically unique was the unprecedented violence and terror directed at millions of their subjects. Mann regards the Nazi and Stalinist dictatorships as two subtypes of the regime of continuous revolution. In his view, they resembled fluid revolutionary movements rather than institutionalized states. As Mann writes, instead of revolutionary ideology and party institutions combining to produce a totalitarian bureaucracy, they undercut each other to produce a less institutionalized, more dynamic and arbitrary despotism. Mann pays considerable attention to revisionist accounts of Stalinism. In principle, he agrees with those historians who argue that Stalin possessed only limited control over the party apparatus. For Mann, it is not surprising that revisionist historians revealed fierce power struggles within the Nazi and Stalinist regimes. Mann identifies the main methods of rule under the regimes of continuous revolution. He notes that Hitler and Stalin used the divide-and-rule strategy, encouraging rivalries among their subordinates. Mann emphasizes that both dictators cultivated informal, personalistic networks around them. In addition, party officials not so much followed formal rules, but rather tried to guess the leader's intentions. The officials could only look for hints at the desired policy. Obviously, these features of the regimes deviated considerably from the model of rule-governed rational bureaucracy. Mann's approach evidently has some advantages over the totalitarian model. However, it may be argued that Mann's analysis of Stalinism is applicable, first of all, to the period of the 1930s. In the subsequent stage of the development, this regime can hardly be described as a fluid social movement. In the post-war period, the regime strengthened its legitimacy and became much more institutionalized. Mann's main concern is explaining the mass terror under Nazism and Stalinism. That seems to be the reason why he focuses on the more chaotic phase of the dynamics of Stalin's regime in the 1930s. However, what is lacking in Mann's analysis of Stalinism is appreciation of the cultural context. Mann concentrates on the institutional traits that were similar in both regimes of continuous revolution. At the same time, he tends to diminish the role of ideology in Stalinism. Mann takes for granted the revolutionary utopian tradition represented by Marxism and Bolshevism, which was intensified and perverted by Stalinism. It can be argued that Mann's approach tends to limit the cultural dimension to political or social interests and institutions, rather than to consider the relative autonomy of the cultural sphere and the cultural contradictions as sources of political conflict and social change. Civilizational analysis as an emerging paradigm of historical sociology focuses on cultural factors and their impact on the political sphere. The rise of this paradigm can be seen in the context of a more general trend connected with the cultural turn in social sciences. Civilizational analysis has been elaborated in particular by Shmuel Eisenstadt and Professor Johan Arnason. And their theories seem to be relevant for the study of political processes in Soviet time-type societies. Thus, Johan Arnason, in his book The Future That Failed, focuses on the imperial background and character of the Soviet regime. As the German sociologist Wilfried Spohn has argued, this work can be considered a highly original civilizational approach to the communist regimes in Russia and other parts of the world that deserves further theoretical development and comparative research. It is true that this book was written before the full elaboration of the civilizational theory. However, Arnason addresses the problematic of communist modernity in several other works. First of all, he considers the Russian cultural and political tradition, which combined a peripheral position within the Western world with some traits of a separate civilization. In particular, he focuses on the character of the imperial modernization in Russia and argues that the origins and later transformation of the totalitarian project could only be understood with reference to that background. From this viewpoint, the Soviet model incorporated both the legacy of imperial transformation from above and the revolutionary vision of a new society, and their synthesis led to a reunified and rearticulated tradition which served to structure a specific version of modernity. In his analysis of the Stalinist regime, Arnason draws on the theory of totalitarianism. Although he admits that one could speak of a totalitarian project rather than a fully fledged totalitarian system, the starting point for his discussion was the approaches worked out by Claude Lefort and Cornelius Castoriadis. For Arnason, attempts of some revisionist historians to present the purges of the late 1930s as a result of social conflicts did not look very convincing. According to Arnason, there were differences between the pre-war and the post-war constellation. As he writes, the autocratic regime and the enlarged empire seemed to reinforce each other. Stalin's rule was re-legitimized by victory and expansion. On the other hand, the imperial legacy re-emerged as a more independent factor after downgrading of the totalitarian regime. Project. At this stage, the Soviet system turned to global expansionism instead of internal mobilization. In his discussion of the period from the mid-60s to the mid-80s, Arnason distinguishes between two main trends in the dynamics of the Soviet regime: the internal one of retraditionalization and the external one of globalization. In his view, the trend to retraditionalization was evident in attempts to present the Soviet way of life as a specific tradition during the Brezhnev period. when there was a conservative shift towards defense of really existing socialism. The Soviet system defined itself as an alternative to Western modernity. It was supposed to transcend Western societies in the economic, political, and cultural spheres. But in each of these spheres, there were some contradictions in communist modernity. Central planning was to be reconciled with technological progress, party sovereignty with active but guided participation, and immutable doctrinal principles with unlimited growth of scientific knowledge. Imerson demonstrates different strategies of crisis management used by the communist regimes. Thus, he refers to the Czechoslovak reform movement of the 1960s and Gorbachev's attempt to restructure the Soviet Empire, which resulted in radical and irreversible change. Imerson disagrees with those observers who regarded the reformist turn of the Soviet leaders as the triumph of civil society or a kind of revolt of the middle classes. He believes that the reformist center was not acting in response to civil society, but rather following its own strategy. As he argues, the reformist leadership remained confident that the communist project could be revitalized. Thus, he emphasizes that the idea of glasnost reflects an optimistic view of Soviet culture as an established tradition and of its self-reflective potential, while underestimation of the national problems could be seen as a result of belief in the unifying and assimilating power of Soviet culture. Finally, Arneson emphasizes the need to re-evaluate communism as a world historical phenomenon in the global context. As he claims, most approaches to the study of communist societies were based on Soviet and Eastern European experience. Much less attention was devoted by researchers to the Chinese model of communism. And in one of his works, he considers the development of entangled communisms in the USSR and China. According to Arneson, the civilizational dynamic of the Chinese world poses a challenge to the Western theory and historiography. On the whole, this approach allows us to reconsider the Soviet model as a specific form of modernity. Now, if we turn to the example of political transformations in post-communist Russia, first of all, it should be noted that the experience of post-Soviet Russia proved to be a difficult case for democratization studies. At the same time, the unexpected repoliticization of Russian society since the end of 2011 poses some new problems for research in this field. Apparently, we should be looking for new theoretical perspectives that can account for both the persistence of authoritarian trends in Russian politics and the possibility of overcoming these trends. It is widely believed that the reversal of democratization in Russia occurred basically from 2000 to 2004. Consolidation of presidential power, weakening of civil society, loss of independence of the parliament and regional politicians have been seen as evidence of creeping authoritarianism. The processes of political transformation in Russia have been discussed mainly from the positions of transitology as a branch of political science, which tends to lack the historical dimension. The new perspectives in historically oriented political sociology have been mostly ignored by representatives of this approach. The concept of de-democratization has been elaborated in contemporary historical sociology in the works of Charles Tilly, who has also discussed the example of post-Soviet Russia. At the same time, the processes of de-democratization can be studied from the viewpoint of other theoretical perspectives. For a long time, political sociology was developing within the modernization paradigm influenced by structural functionalism. However, several alternative approaches emerged in political sociology. Thus, Wilfried Spohn discusses the main counter-trends against functionalist evolutionism. These include critical political sociology focused on power and inequality, neo-Marxism focused on class conflict in capitalist development, post-structuralist and post-modernist approaches, and finally, global political sociology, in which a special place belongs to the multiple modernities perspective. But within this global political sociology, there are also some other approaches, and for example, the American sociologist Randall Collins formulated a macro-sociological theory that emphasized the role of geopolitics. Collins argued that Max Weber's typology of the forms of legitimate domination should be complemented with analysis of the dynamics of legitimacy, which depends on the state's prestige at the international arena. According to Collins, geopolitical success of Britain and the United States increased the legitimacy of democracy in these countries. On the other hand, a military defeat or loss of great power status leads to decline of legitimacy of any political regime. In principle, this approach can be applied to both democratization and de-democratization processes. Collins also considered the prospects for Russian democracy. In his view, these prospects seemed to be dim if only the political culture was taken into account. Nevertheless, he maintained that a favorable geopolitical configuration could strengthen democracy in Russia. According to Collins, the return of at least modest geopolitical power prestige could increase the legitimacy of Russian democratic institutions. However, it turned out that the gradual restoration of the power prestige of the Russian state took place not during the democratization phase, but coincided with a renewed trend to authoritarianism in the 2000s. Thus, the geopolitical factor strengthened the legitimacy of the semi-authoritarian plebiscitary regime. At the same time, it should be noted that Collins's analysis demonstrates a peculiar kind of geopolitical determinism. Collins is constantly emphasizing the influence of geopolitical factors while diminishing the role of other causes of social change. He tends to oppose his geopolitical theory to approaches that focus on social and cultural preconditions for democracy. Nevertheless, the geopolitical theory of democratization can be combined with other sociological approaches. The political regime in post-Soviet Russia has been discussed recently in a comparative historical context, but from the perspective of political science by the American scholar Stephen Hansen. He considers the political regime that emerged in Russia after the collapse of communism an example of post-imperial democracy. Hansen compares the situation in post-Soviet Russia with the Third Republic in France and the Weimar Republic in Germany. According to Hansen, there were many similarities between these three cases. He believes that the legacies of past imperial institutions constrained the new democratic elites in similar ways. In all three cases, the imperial collapse was followed by a period of political instability and uncertainty before the consolidation of a new regime. But the character of this new regime was different in each case. Democracy in France, dictatorship in Germany, and weak state authoritarianism in Russia. In Hansen's view, political ideology was the main factor leading to these particular outcomes. Hansen focuses on party formation in the three countries. He claims that in the cases of France and Germany, ideological parties tended to defeat pragmatic parties, and the new regime consolidated along the lines of the most successful ideology. In the case of Russia, no ideological party succeeded, and all parties were finally subordinated to the authoritarian state, which lacked any clear and consistent ideology. Hansen's final conclusion is that ideology plays a crucial role in determining the fate of uncertain democracies. At the same time, he believes that in Russia, a more consistent democratic ideology might have helped liberal parties to resist the trend towards authoritarianism. Apparently, the absence of a coherent democratic or anti-democratic ideology can be considered one of the factors that affected the regime consolidation in Russia. However, Hansen's political science perspective does not allow to appreciate the role of social forces, which could be the carriers of a particular ideology. In addition, the concept of political ideology, which is understood primarily as party ideology, seems to be too narrow. But in any case, Hansen's approach is a step forward in comparison with most transitological studies. It should be noted that Hansen criticizes the civilizational approach to Russian politics and culture. As he writes, civilizational theories are bound to look good when democratic prospects in non-Western countries look bleakest. They are equally bound to misunderstand the dynamic social changes that continue to reshape Eurasia and the world over the century to come. Hansen refers to Richard Pipes and Samuel Huntington as representatives of such civilizational approach. But he disregards the multiple modernities theory, which focuses on the dynamics of various civilizations of modernity. Hansen's analysis of Russian politics demonstrates the advantages of a comparative historical perspective, but his approach can be complemented with a more detailed study of cultural dynamics from the viewpoint of the multiple modernities theory. Civilizational analysis as a paradigm of comparative historical sociology demonstrates the influence of the cultural program of modernity on the formation of constitutional democratic regimes and reveals the role of cultural factors in the peculiarities of political institutions in non-Western states. Eisenstadt's multiple modernities theory has been characterized by Wilfried Spohn as a crucial alternative to the revived mainstream neo-modernization paradigm, the predominant modes of globalization analysis, as well as the socio-philosophical discourse on modernity and post-modernity. At the same time, as Peter Wagner claims, Eisenstadt's strong idea of cultural program can be applied to classical civilizations, but not so much to contemporary versions of modernity. Wolfgang Knobel argues that Eisenstadt overemphasizes the role of cultural religious mechanism that program the processes of social change. In his view, Eisenstadt has paid sufficient attention to political constellations at the beginnings of civilizations, but his analysis of modern times it is more difficult to identify the actors responsible for the processes of social change. The relevance of civilizational analysis for contemporary political sociology has been discussed recently by Wilfried Spohn. He argues that the major claim of the multiple modernities approach to political sociology is that different civilizational foundations and frameworks generate different programs of political modernity and processes of political modernization. Empires, world religions, and regional economies, as the three major domains of civilizations, have a crucial impact on state formation nation building, national integration, political cultures, public spheres and collective identities, and thus contribute to the varying constellations and trajectories of political modernization. Johan Arnason emphasizes three reference points connected with the study of the Soviet model of modernity: movements, empires, and civilizations. Apparently, the issues of imperial background and civilizational aspects of the Soviet model are related to the problematic of post-Soviet political transformations. The Soviet civilizational legacy played an important role in the reversal of Russian democratization. Before the recent revival of a pro-democratic social movement, it might seem that the problematic of movements was not particularly relevant for the study of Russian politics. But today it is clear that this issue should be reconsidered. The study of post-Soviet Russian politics on the basis of civilizational analysis should take into account three main aspects. First, the influence of religious traditions, particularly Orthodox Christianity. Second, the role of the Soviet model of modernity in reproduction of a certain type of political structures. Third, the impact of Soviet imperial legacy on the political processes. All these traditions, both genuine and invented ones, are interconnected. In addition, there was an impact of Western values and institutions on Russian society, which mostly remained rather superficial. But this impact can also be discussed in terms of civilizational analysis in comparative historical sociology. The idea of Orthodox civilization, which was shared by Samuel Huntington and some Russian authors, seems to be ill-founded. Recent political processes in Russia have been influenced mostly by the legacy of the Soviet model of modernity and the imperial legacy, and to a much lesser degree by the Orthodox tradition. At the same time, a distinction should be made between the religious tradition of Orthodoxy and the Russian Orthodox Church as an institution. This religious tradition should not be seen as inherently anti-democratic, although it has had difficulties in engagement with liberal democracy. As Peter Berger notes, the Orthodox idea of harmonious unity between society, state, and church constitutes a distinctive challenge to the acceptance of liberal democracy, making it only slightly preferable to anarchy. But Berger points out that Roman Catholicism had similar difficulties before the Second Vatican Council. It can be argued that the spirit of the Orthodox religion seems to have no elective affinity with any particular type of political regime, but it is rather indifferent towards all of them. On the other hand, the pattern of relations between Russian state and the Orthodox Church as an institution in the post-Soviet years has been largely reminiscent of the pre-revolutionary period. The Church has been used by the authorities as a barrier against liberal ideas, a symbol of ethno-confessional unity and glorious past. It has also provided with the ideas of isolationism and Russia's specific way of development. On the whole, the authorities express instrumental attitude to the Church, which is supposed to compensate the lack of legitimacy of the political regime. But the direct political influence of the Russian Orthodox Church remained quite insignificant. The civilizational identity of the Soviet system was formed by Marxism-Leninism as a kind of political religion. However, from the viewpoint of civilizational analysis, one can speak rather of a Soviet model of modernity that possessed only some civilizational characteristics. According to Arnason, the secular religion of Marxism-Leninism did not penetrate society to the same extent as historical religions. attempts to present the Soviet way of life as a specific tradition did not lead to a sustainable civilizational pattern. Presumably, the remnants of this invented tradition can hardly serve as a solid basis of legitimacy of a post-communist political regime. Nevertheless, the studies of contemporary Russian political culture demonstrate that some of the neo-traditionalist aspects of the Soviet model remained influential in the 2000s. In this period, public opinion in Russia generally accepted the Soviet epoch and particularly expressed nostalgia for the golden age of Brezhnev's rule. Most of the population regarded the Brezhnev period with its relative well-being and social homogeneity as the best time in the 20th century Russian history. On the whole, this period could be characterized as the apex of the Soviet social-political order. This period was also the time of socialization of Putin's generation, and apparently it is the late phase of Brezhnev's rule that should be taken into as the point of departure in analysis of Putin's regime. The issue of the impact of the Soviet imperial legacy on today's Russian politics should also be considered. Although Russia is no longer an empire, some features that emerged in the imperial period continue to influence the political processes in the country. Most of the post-imperial states were transformed into nation-states, but in the case of Russia, this process was not completed. The French political scientist Pierre Asner makes a distinction between virtual democracy and virtual empire. Virtual democracy is imitation of democratic mechanisms that conceals authoritarian tendencies of the political regime. The main purpose of maintaining the appearance of democracy is to preserve the regime's respectability in the eyes of the West. For Asner, Russia's foreign policy can be understood only if the post-imperial humiliation and resentment of the people and neo-imperial ambitions of its leaders are taken into consideration. However, today's Russia lacks the resources to support confrontation with the West and a coherent ideology justifying such confrontation. In this situation, the ruling elite has chosen to pretend that Russia is again becoming a superpower. As a result, virtual democracy, which is meant to gain legitimacy in the eyes of the outside world, is complemented by virtual empire, which is intended to strengthen the regime's legitimacy inside the country. Perhaps one could speak of a virtual great power rather than virtual empire, but the concept of empire is also relevant in this case. On the whole, the problems that the Soviet imperial and great power legacies posed for the processes of democratization in Russia have been discussed by some scholars. According to the British political scientist Richard Sakwa, the intersection of and possibly contradiction between the great power and democratization agendas is one of the unique features of Russia's transformation process. The Russian scholar Lilia Shevtsova notes that no imperial superpower with messianic pretensions had ever successfully democratized. Although Russia ceased to be a superpower and the messianic pretensions of Marxism-Leninism lost their appeal, the legacies of the Soviet Empire and the communist model of modernity continued to influence Russian politics in the 2000s. So, political transformations in Russia during the last decade can be regarded as an authoritarian turn of a post-imperial democracy, which can be studied from a comparative historical perspective. However, this case represents a specific historical constellation. On the one hand, Russia was the core of the former Soviet Empire. In this respect, it differs from other post-communist states. On the other hand, the new political regime in Russia emerged as a result of disintegration of the communist version of modernity. This separates Russia from those post-imperial democracies which belonged to the Western world. The dynamics of democratization and de-democratization in Russia represent a case of path dependency, which is both post-imperial and post-communist. Apparently, civilizational analysis in comparative historical sociology allows us to account for this constellation better than other approaches to post-Soviet politics. Thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, I would be glad to try to answer them. Or comments, perhaps.
I would have a very naive question, but it may be. Maybe it was not. Are you an optimist for Russia or a pessimist?
Maybe in the long run I could be a moderate optimist, but in the near future I do not see any possibility of genuine radical change. But you see, during the winter months when there were rather large-scale political protests in Russia, there were a lot of hopes that some change could be introduced very quickly, but it turned out that the Putin regime is still strong enough, and although the civil society in Russia awakened after a rather long sleep, but still it is not very powerful, and it will take some time for strengthening these sources of possible change of the political regime.
And if I can add, because you were beginning with Barrington Moore,
yes.
Do you think that this strengthening of the civil society is related with the emergence of a middle class?
Well, to some extent, yes, I think so, because you see, of course, Barrington Moore discussed different historical epochs, and he considered the bourgeois revolutions, the classical bourgeois revolutions, and also some other routes to the modern world represented by the authoritarian revolutions from above and the peasant revolutions in Russia and China. But still, his main conclusion that the middle class is essential for democracy seems to be quite relevant. And if we consider the recent protest movement in Russia, it was mainly the representatives of well-educated urban middle class who participated in all these meetings and demonstrations. And it was mostly in the big cities, particularly in Moscow. Of course, in other cities, Russian cities, even in relatively big cities, these protests were not so widespread as it was in Moscow. In Russia, we have a very specific kind of middle class. a large amount of what is usually considered the middle class is composed of the state bureaucracy, which has very different interests and which supports the existing political regime. But still there is also another part of this middle class represented by the new professional strata in the big cities, and they were very active in the last winter's protests.
Yeah, listening to it has made me sort of uncomfortably conscious of the fact that I haven't done any work on communism for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But if I try to think back, there is one fundamental and paradoxical fact that leads me towards the war. If you do a comparative historical sociology of the Soviet model, there are two sort of historical dimensions take into account. There are the transformations within Russia and there are the variations outside Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And the paradox is that one of the variants now seems to loom so large in world history that it's beginning to overshadow the original. I mean China.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the Chinese seem to be doing at the moment is a world historical balancing act, combining a Leninist model of statehood with a capitalist model of development. And moreover, there are learning processes on both levels. I mean, on the capitalist level, they're learning from the experience of Western capitalism, also from the East Asian developmental states, including Japan. On the, shall we say, Leninist level, they are learning from both Soviet and Maoist experience, plus the distinctively Chinese episode of the Kuomintang, partial appropriation of Leninism, because in some ways the communist regime is beginning to look rather more like Kuomintang than the Communist Party that overthrew it in 1949. Would you like to comment on that? How do you see the significance of China in this whole framework?
Of course, the Chinese example is very significant indeed, and the main problem for me is that I do not know this example very well, and my knowledge of Chinese affairs is very limited. And you see, last November I attended a conference at the University of Helsinki, which was devoted to the processes of transformation of in Russia and China, and there were mostly experts on Russia and on China, and there were very few, if any, people who combined expertise on both these societies. So yes, it's really difficult to.
So, any other questions? So, if there is no more questions,
I could
yes.
Have another one, because for me it was terribly interesting. My questions are maybe less question of historical sociology, or maybe less civilizational, or maybe a little bit, and but are related with my personal interest. As I have Polish origins, maybe I have like a Polish deformation, but it seems to me that Poland is to a certain extent important for Russia. So it seems to be strange because a little Poland in front of a huge Russia. But there is that question of civilizational, we are speaking of the world of discourses, of civilizational, the clash of civilization of Huntington as our neighbors. Poland is considering itself as being very Catholic. The civil society movement, I noticed that there was a movement called Solidarity, referring to the Polish Solidarity movement. The National Day in Russia is the day of when Russia won the war with Poland. And there is the quite hot topic or the two hot topics of the Katyn massacre and the Smolensk accident. But do you think that the Poland is really some kind of important, or is it my just personal deformation? And could you tell me a little bit how you could enter to your analyze?
Yes, I think so. That of course, Poland is important, and very important in this respect. And the Polish reform movement of Solidarity was really some kind of example for people who wanted some political change in Russia. And of course, the accident in Smolensk is not it's not such a hot issue in Russia as it is in Poland, where, as far as I know, it's just one of the main, of the most important political issues that divided the Polish society. And the Katyn tragedy, of course, it meant much more for people in Poland. And in Russia, in it was there was some kind of reluctance at first to accept the guilt for this crime of the Stalinist regime. And in any case, in the media, not much attention is devoted to this topic today. But the relations with Poland are, in many ways, they are quite important for today's Russia. And as for this civilizational split, of course, it was evident even at the time when Poland was some regions of Poland were a part of the Russian Empire, and Poland and Finland were the two regions which were considered very alien to the other parts of that empire. And so there was some kind of inter-civilizational encounter within the same empire at that time. So I think that yes, this approach can to some extent be used in considering the rather difficult relations between Russia and Poland.
Yeah, on Poland and Russia, there is a very interesting book by a German historian called Klaus Czernak, who is one of the great German experts in East Central Europe. It's sort of entangled history of Poland and Russia, you know, an attempt to write a history of the two countries in the Neuzeit, in the modern age, as you call it in German a Beziehungsgeschichte. Interrelated histories. That book has been translated into Polish, and when Putin came on his first official visit to Poland, this would have been in the late 90s, I think, Kwasniewski was president, he presented a copy of it to Putin. But that's all I know about its reception in Russia. I wonder, has this book been become known in Russia?
Well, I haven't heard. I haven't heard about it. I'm not sure if it was translated into Russian. Perhaps not. But well, one more example. One Russian historian has edited with his Polish colleagues. They have edited a book of political cartoons, both Russian and Soviet and Polish, of the period between the the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the beginning of the Second World War. And so there are some striking parallels between these cartoons and the perception of the other side was quite similar in both countries at that time. Well, the question of the Russian middle class is rather complicated, and there are lively debates about the actual place of the middle class in Russian society. And in fact, during the Soviet period, there was some group which was in many ways analogous to the middle class in Western societies. It was the Soviet intelligentsia, but after the economic reforms of the 1990s, it mostly lost its position, and the new middle class began to form. But as I said, it consisted of several groups which were quite incompatible with each other, and the stratum of state officials, which grew quite rapidly in post-Soviet Russia, possessed